Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Now, today marks the first anniversary of the Hamas assault on October 7th. And later on in the show, we'll be reflecting on the conflict that has raged across the region ever since. But we're starting this morning in Lebanon, where another night of heavy Israeli bombardment appears to have set off secondary explosions. In a few moments, we'll speak to former Irish Air Corps Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Byrne about the pressures facing Ireland. UN peacekeepers on the Israeli-Lebanese border. But first, we're joined from Beirut by Guardian reporter Ruth Michelson. Ruth, thank you for joining us this morning. So there's been another weekend of heavy bombing in the Lebanese capital, and the scale of this is ramping up. I know you've been talking to people who are attempting to stay, attempting to leave, and some trying to get on with their day-to-day lives.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, over the weekend, we saw early on Sunday morning, one of maybe the heaviest night of bombardment, certainly since Israel ramped up attacks on the Lebanese capital on the 23rd of September. There were reports that these bombardments struck a petrol station, a hotel that is on the way to the airport. There's understandably a lot of anxiety about the airport remaining open. Only the Lebanese national carrier is still running. And there are people, as you say, that want to get on with their lives, are trying to have some normality in some parts of the city as much as they can. And then other people who are looking to flee any way that they have the means to, whether it's using the national carrier to get out of the airport, or whether it's fleeing for the mountains around Beirut, or whether it's going to another area that they hoped would be safer.
Can we talk a little bit about those conversations that you had with people? Because I was reading your piece this morning, and you describe two people sitting on a balcony and freezing in fear when they heard and saw the explosions.
Absolutely. I mean, these are young students. They're both in university. They both just want to get on with their studies. One of them attends a university that has a campus in the area that is being struck with very heavy Israeli airstrikes on a nightly basis at the moment in the southern suburbs of Beirut. And these are people that said, well, you know, we fled with our families up into the mountains earlier on, and then our house up in the mountains is now so full of people that we wanted to come back down to another location a little bit closer to the strike zone over the weekend, just so that we could have a little bit of privacy, a little bit of space. And then the airstrikes were so heavy that they, as you say, they was sat on the balcony, and suddenly there are airstrikes that they can see, that they absolutely froze in fear, and now are, as they told me, retreating back into the mountains again, trying to get on with their lives and their studies, doing one of them going to study online. He told me his university will be online, but they're now in an area where they said, you know, actually the internet here is worse because it's just packed with people that have fled southern Beirut.
And fears too around food supplies.
Yes, I spoke to someone who runs a very popular restaurant bar in the center of Beirut. And he was telling me that he is thinking of closing, not just because people don't feel comfortable being out in the evenings, but also because he's concerned about how they will get food. So Lebanon at the moment has over a million people that have been displaced by the estimates of the Lebanese government. And the vast majority of those people are coming from agricultural areas across southern Lebanon, across some parts of eastern Lebanon, but predominantly in the south. Those people are working in agriculture in some way, and a lot of them are involved in food, in produce production, so growing fruits and vegetables, and others are producing they are the key suppliers of things like chicken and forms of meat. And so what he was telling me is that with all of these displaced people, that also has displaced vital food production lines, And so this means that they will be looking to new suppliers. If, you know, anyone in the capital, these new suppliers would be from the north. That's going to bring up food prices even more. Lebanon is already a very expensive country, and it is threatening to become even more expensive as people are getting increasingly desperate.
So you'll have some people from the wealthy and middle class in Beirut moving perhaps to a holiday home or some alternative accommodation that they've arranged for themselves, while Beirut is filling with people who have come with nothing, not even the basics, and have nowhere to go. Some of whom, as you report today, are staying in places like nightclubs, and some of whom have nowhere to sleep and are on the streets.
That's right. I mean, I think it's really important to mention here that predominantly when I've been out speaking to people who have been sleeping on the streets for a prolonged period of time, that those people tend to be guest workers from South Asia, or they are Syrian refugees who fled to Lebanon to flee the fighting or the regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria, and that these people are not necessarily getting access to shelters. The Lebanese government has set up or established almost 900 shelters. They're makeshift shelters in schools. And what the UN said at the end of last week is that these 900 shelters across Lebanon now are full. And so now we are seeing nightclubs, private institutions, private homes, people, you know, opening facilities for those who are displaced. But what the people at the nightclub told me is that, you know, they want to be considerate to the 400 people inside this nightclub and not just keep letting people in, because they said, you know, we're worried that if we let lots more people in, that this is going to create an unstable situation, a difficult situation for the people seeking shelter here. Mm-hmm. And so these people are obviously thinking about this in the long term. People don't think about this as a problem that's going to be solved tomorrow, because even if the fighting stopped, a lot of these people who have been displaced from the south don't know if they have homes to return to.
And what is the general sense that you're getting from those conversations you're having? Are they keen to see retribution for these attacks, or do they just want peace now, and do they want their normal lives to resume?
I mean, I think it's fair to say that however people feel about the response, everybody wants an end to these attacks. They want to see an end to what is happening in Gaza. They want to see an end to Israeli attacks on Lebanon. Some people, when I speak to them, say the solution for this is about Hezbollah winning a battle on the borders in the south. That means a battle for the whole country will be won. One thing that unites people, however they feel about Hezbollah, is that what they all say is that what they fear the most is the Israeli reoccupation of southern Lebanon. And so the increasing Israeli ground incursions, posters and online flyers that have gone around talking about the an Israeli settler movement for southern Lebanon, as far away, as remote a possibility as that might be, that is something that really frightens people here in Lebanon. And it's something where they want to see their government step up and make sure this doesn't happen. They want to see their military, in some cases, focus on this. And some people say, well, the solution, because our military is desperately underfunded, or the Lebanese military is so desperately underfunded, that the solution for them, in their from their perspective, is that Hezbollah has to win this battle.
Okay, Ruth, thank you very much for bringing us that overview. That's Ruth Michelson, who is a journalist writing for The Guardian in Lebanon. As I said, Kevin Byrne is with us too, former Air Corps Lieutenant Colonel. And we want to talk about southern Lebanon, Kevin. As Ruth was mentioning there, a lot of the focus and attention now is on what happens next. Our own defence forces confirmed yesterday that all personnel, Irish personnel, are well and accounted for. But there's no doubt about it, they're in a very precarious position, Kevin, aren't they?
Good morning, Claire. Indeed, they are. A post 652 is quite close to what was the agreed border after the Israelis pulled out of South Lebanon as long ago now as year 2000. But the reports I've read are that outside the post, quite close, between distances of 60 metres and out to 200 metres, were a couple of their very powerful Mark IV Merkava tanks, which were firing on the Hezbollah positions as far as they saw it. And they were also surrounded by M113 APCs, the tracked vehicles carrying the troops that support all this kind of thing, you know. And I can see why they went there, because, of course, that post is particularly good from the critical point of view. They can keep, you know, visual contact with what's going on around them. And that's what the idea of UNIFIL was to be the eyes and ears of the UN reporting back any breaches. But this is an invasion. So in that regard, you would have to hope that both parties, the IDF and the Hezbollah, understand what UNIFIL is there for, and they should be respecting the agreements they have put in place to keep them safe in that regard. Mm-hmm. Now, the personal equipment carried by the soldiers, their own gear, the vehicles and the buildings in which they are stationed are much better than when I was there. They're a far higher standard in that regard. So they're quite safe if they stay in the lockdown position. They will, of course, have people on the roof of the buildings keeping tabs on what's going on, reporting by radio back to UNIFIL headquarters down in Nakura. So I've no great fears about that. The electricity supply is a problem because the generators they use will need fuel, as will the vehicles, and they might need, you know, certainly water and food, and that will have been in stock for a while. I think 30 days was the normal.
Okay.
It may have been used to some extent, but they want to resupply soon enough, I suppose.
But Kevin, going back to what you said there about the Israeli tanks and then those vehicles carrying the troops to back them up, I mean, there's no doubt about it. They are targets, aren't they, in this?
Yes. This was a feature. The Israelis want the UNIFIL gone, which is a bit naive in that regard. And I suspect that the corporate memory in the Israeli Defence Forces isn't more than 4 or 5 years. So the people who have come to the border to invade Lebanon may have been in Gaza. They may be head up. They may be, you know, soldiers looking for promotion or looking for, you know, a quick fix, as it were. And they tell UNIFIL, get lost. You're getting in the way of our battle from that point of view. But that isn't how it works. And the good news is, I suppose, there's constant contact between UNIFIL using people like liaison officers to the Israeli Defense Forces and Hezbollah and other parties in the area to negotiate, you know, a safe passage if there's supplies required for post 652 or anywhere else for that matter, and to understand what UNIFIL is there for. They're not a threat to either side. They're just getting in the way, as it were, of the battles. The Israelis, by parking close to UN, I think hope that the counter-battery fire, as it were, from Hezbollah won't be fired at them. But I'm not sure if that's naive, because I don't really know, do Hezbollah have the intentions, the good intentions of keeping the UNIFIL force safe? It's very hard to tell at this remove.
So in your experience, the rules of war and the rules around the UNIFIL troops and their role always pretty well respected, but we are in an unprecedented situation here, do you agree?
Yes, and in the fog of war, in the heat of battle, people, you know, if they're being fired on from either side, if they see their own friends and comrades being shot on either side or otherwise injured, they may not consider that UNIFIL is an important element, and they'll say, to heck with this, we're not going to bother. But that hasn't come to pass so far, and better news I've heard in the last couple of hours are that those armoured vehicles have moved deeper into Lebanon, leaving the post a little bit less surrounded than it was. So I think as the battle goes north into Lebanon, I mean, the distance will make it safer for those troops, and perhaps they'll be able to get a resupply mission in to that post today or tomorrow or the next day. I'd hope that would be the case.
All right, so that may be good news if you're hearing that the Israeli vehicles have moved on, because going back to how you were describing it earlier, it seemed that they were almost using the UNIFIL troops as a shield.
That we had an SOP, a standard operating procedure, when we were, I had lots of different trips to make because I was in headquarters up and down the different areas in the then area of operations, the AO, and we were told, if you're in convoy, and you never went alone, if Israeli troops fit in behind you and join your convoy, pull in and let them go on their own, because they're doing it to shield themselves from any particular attack, in that case probably from Amal, which was an organization in place long before Hezbollah came to fore. You know, so we would have an SOP, pull in, let them wait. We are not going to be a shield or a cover for them. And perhaps that's the reason they're hanging around post 652.
Okay, now the government has reassured the families, particularly of those who are at the outpost, there's about 30 soldiers there, that they're watching this very closely. But like, there's no doubt about it, it's a very worrying time for those families. Will they be receiving regular updates? Is that possible?
It is. The problem is, you see, people have such instant communications. In my day, we used to write letters and get the phone call once a week. You know, nowadays it's instant. I heard somebody on the television saying they were concerned because they hadn't had anything on the internet from them, you know, in WhatsApp or so forth, in 5 hours. That's simply because one of two things has happened. Probably the internet has gone down, as we heard earlier. It doesn't. It's a bit fragile in certain parts of the country, as you know. Secondly, the power supply is not guaranteed in different parts of Lebanon, especially with the attacks going on as they are now. So I wouldn't be worried about that at all. What they have, though, is radio contact with, as I said, higher headquarters, UNIFIL, and that'll be in constant contact with Dublin as well. So the Defence Force headquarters, and which is now in Newbridge, of course, will be keeping up to date on all of the things. The Director of Operations will know precisely as soon as it happens something that, you know, is good news or otherwise, and they will get in touch with their command brigade areas, I should say, and they'll be talking to the family. So I wouldn't worry too much about it. It is of concern because the contact isn't instantaneous and it can't be until these measures are restored. But for the moment, no, they're doing all the right things. They're well trained. They've got experienced people there and they've been here before, by the way.
So is it your view then, given your experience, that there is no immediate danger to these soldiers?
Yes, there's no immediate danger, I don't think, unless there's a fantastic and unfortunate flare-up of battles in that particular area. UNIFIL, as happened before, is usually bypassed by the Israelis. They're told, and they know very well from their maps and their liaison officers, where UNIFIL posts are, what they do. Patrolling in the normal way, which was kind of showing the flag for the UN, will not take place now while the battle is going on. I mean, as I said, we were here before in 2006 and before that in the 80s and so forth. So there's a good knowledge there as to what might happen. So they stay down until things get better. The matter will resolve itself sooner, if not later, you know. So they take all the necessary precautions and they will be, you know, safe enough for the moment.
All right. Well, Kevin, thank you very much. Kevin Byrne there. And we'll have more on this first anniversary of the October 7th attacks from the Middle East as we go through the programme. Next, though, Harry McGee will be with us to talk more about these reports of a Russian spy operating in the Oireachtas.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.